Paperman meets such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it, it's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press. Now you remember Mrs.
The Media Project is a half hour of commentary and analysis where we take a look at what's going on in the news media these days and how things have changed and how things are, how people are or are not well being served. I'm Rex Smith, formerly editor of the Times Union, now with the Upstate American. And I am here with my colleagues, Judy Patrick, who was formerly editor of the Daily Gazette, vice president of the New York Press Association. Judy, howdy.
Hello.
Hello. Okay, thank you. We have Barbara Lombardo, formerly executive editor at the Saratogian and the Record of Troy, teaching at UAlbany these days.
Happy to be here.
We're so happy to have you. David Gustina, our producer, is here, the morning host from WAMC. David, what's new in public radio land?
I don't know, but having looked over the Project 2025, I'm a little worried that they're going to eliminate it entirely.
They are. You know, that's actually one of the first topics we were going to talk about, so why not? Project 2025, the agenda laid out by Heritage Foundation that is so much apparently reflective of what would happen if Donald Trump takes the White House, projects getting rid of funding for public broadcasting, which is $500 some million, right? Would that have a big impact here in WAMC?
Well, I would say in WAMC, it's nice that we have a little bit of a cushion in our listenership in that to make up the difference from NPR, I believe it's now $1 million or $2 million. Don't quote me on that.
Let's split it costs WAMC?
To pay for NPR's offerings for its content. And that is a lot more than we get from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, which would be the money that would be eliminated. Now, could we make that up? Yeah, but it would be harder. And in this current media climate, would we have to sacrifice some staff positions or something else in order to make up the difference? It's possible. We're, again, as I mentioned last time I was on, we have a new CEO. She's looking at all these things for sure. And one of the things we're always threatened with by Republican administrations, more specifically, is they're going to take the money away. We didn't often take that with very much seriousness because it always seemed to be back in the budget. But this seems to be a clear plan, not only to take the call of the press being the enemy of the people by Donald Trump, but formalizing in Project 2025, where they literally say public broadcasting can no longer be classified as educational. In fact, they see it as, quote, non-educational and claim it is a biased liberal forum engaged in suppressing conservative views. To that end, they consider unjustly privileged outlets that include the public broadcasting service, PBS, and National Public Radio should be defunded and stripped of their status as non-commercial educational stations and thereby required to pay hefty licensing fees.
Wow, wouldn't that fundamentally change the character of public radio, which does have a mission of educating people? I mean, it's one of the reasons you're able to air things like the opera or public service programming that may not get the kind of listenership that, you know, a wild and crazy talk show might. It's in part because you're subsidized. If you are forced to operate like a commercial radio station, you will become just like all the other commercial radio stations, and we will lose perhaps the opera, perhaps some of the classical programming, perhaps some of the news programs that are so essential to public radio.
Are you saying that we're offering more spinach than ice cream?
Well, there is a reason why the only good news programming on radio in America is done by public radio. I hate to generalize, but you don't hear great news programming on commercial radio anywhere anymore.
And for those people who are not particular opera fans, I think that's a valid point, but the risk is even greater of what you lose in terms of education. So the 51% show that's on NPR is one small example of
the type of reporting that delves into issues that are local and national, and the national reporting that happens, and stuff for children. And it's not indoctrination, it's education. And it's sort of like at a newspaper when there would be concerns about, are we going to have to drop a section of the paper because it doesn't bring in revenue, whatever it might be. But you know, for the greater good of the total product and for the audience that you're trying to serve, that not everything that you're providing is going to be making money.
Yeah, let's be clear. By the way, we had a wonderful letter from Mark, a professor who listens to us from Poughkeepsie, talking about our conversation the other day about the decline of WCBS News Radio 880, which now is no longer an all-news station. And he writes that he, growing up in New Jersey, heard the station all the time. And he says, I'm struck with great sadness as WCBS News Radio signs off, but it makes me realize how privileged I have been to have grown up with such a resource, and how grateful I am that WAMC has been and continues to be my source of news and inspiration for civic engagement. Thank you for all that you do. Very nicely.
Right back to what I was talking about our audience. They seem to really value not just National Public Radio and what they're doing, but what we are doing as WAMC and keeping them informed on the regional and local issues that confront them.
But just be clear, however, that if Project 2025 becomes the Trump agenda and Trump is in the White House, it's actually a lot of rural areas would be especially hard hit, because Northeast Public Radio does have the Albany metropolitan area, the Berkshires, and so on, which do have other news sources. But there are a lot of areas across the country where public radio is the only source of news and information. And that is something that we ought to think about. And that's actually why public broadcasting has managed to withstand Republican assaults in the past, because a lot of these rural Republican legislators recognize that their constituents depend upon public radio.
But there's something else here, isn't there, Rex? And that's that big newspapers like Hearst and others, they will have lobbyists in Washington arguing against this kind of cut to funding or a change in the system. And it's hard oftentimes for news organizations to lobby for themselves in their news stories. I mean, we're talking about it now on the Media Project, but it wouldn't really be appropriate. Wouldn't there be the potential for people to look at us with bias? Oh, look at you trying to protect your own interests.
Yeah. Just to be clear, I don't think that corporate media that I'm aware of, like the newspaper chain I used to work for, Hearst, did not have.
They're not going to jump on the bandwagon to help NPR necessarily.
Oh, I don't
know. Do you
know.
Think they will?
Don't you think?
I think they would.
I would hope they would.
I would hope. Yeah, I think so. It's interesting. By the way, that figure comes out to $1.60 per U.S. citizen for public broadcasting per year. So that seems like a reasonable amount of money.
I thought you told us about an organization that lobbies on behalf.
Well, there are lobbying organizations. I guess that's true, that everybody pays a little bit into that. But it's primarily the commercial side of things. That's right. The advertising and so on.
Yep. Yeah.
Good point. In any case, that is something to think about when we hear about Project 2025 and all of the elements of it that are being discussed, have been discussed over the past week at the Democratic National Convention, which brings us conveniently to our next topic. What do we think about all of this? Judy, let me start with you, because you are actually a good consumer of media, in addition to having been a creator of over the years. How appropriate do we think is all of the attention on these national conventions these days? Aren't they primarily just shows?
Right, they're marketing endeavors. And I'm just hoping that nothing major happens, because it's going to be overlooked. There's so much attention paid on these conventions, and it's been such a long week. Couldn't they have wrapped this up in 2 or 3 days? My other big complaint has been how late into the night they go and how many speakers of no consequence are talking. There have been some barn burner speeches, and I have truly enjoyed watching many of them. But it's just marketing. Oh, we're not getting any substance. We still haven't seen an interview Kamala Harris has done with a legitimate journalist. So it is marketing. It's very slick marketing. They're going in all different directions. They're on social media. They've got clips out there. They're drawing in high name entertainers. So very successful marketing, but monopolizing the news cycle in a way that really isn't justified in terms of educating the public. It's really energizing.
Now, whose fault is that?
I know. It's the media's fault. It's true. It's the whole political journalist class. They've been covering this presidential election for the last 4 years, and there's 2,000 journalists there. It's like, we're overdoing it. Why does every small newspaper in the United States have to send somebody to the convention just so they can put it on their resume that they did?
That's an excellent point. It's kind of a perk to be able to be a reporter who gets to go, or to be a news organization who sends a person. At least internally, that's a self-congratulatory moment in journalism. But for the viewers, for the audiences, it serves absolutely no purpose. I mean, you could be talking to your local delegates and seeing how excited they are to be there. It is just a show, as you say, Judy. And we, the media, covered both of the conventions, the Republican and the Democrat, I think, equally. We're equally attentive to both. And this turned into, I can't remember who said this, that people thought it went from being awake to a wedding. And so it was the joyousness of it, whatever.
More and fun to cover a wedding, of course.
More fun to be there. And, you know, you could do what I heard on WMC's roundtable, got a localization of the event by talking to the mayor of Albany, who was one of the delegates there. So there's a way to do it without being there. That said, the bubble's about to burst. And by the time this is ready for listeners, when we're taping this, the final night hasn't happened yet. And by the time you listen to the bubble's burst, the party's over, literally, and the fighting is going to begin. The job numbers, the things about Kamala Harris, you know, Republicans are going to be hitting her. So we'll see what happens.
David, can you make an argument, a countervailing argument, in favor of coverage of the convention extensively?
Overall, no. But I can make a couple of arguments that I think haven't been made yet. One is something that you always talk about when you tried to separate print journalism from television journalism. And TV journalism is largely an entertainment medium.
Yes, sir.
This is a show.
It's a show.
And not only does the show have to go on and be covered ad nauseum, but then you have within the room the personalities that are going to come up. Ezra Klein, why do we care? Why should a media person become a star because they're just asking questions like they should be? You know, that's the kind of nonsense that, unfortunately, Americans are going to gravitate toward. They want the show. They want the excitement. They want all this stuff. So we're giving them the ice cream here. The issue that bothers me on some level is that they're giving, and this is one of our articles, all these influencers basically press credentials to be in that room. And what's happening? We're bypassing the traditional press once again. The politicians, those in government, have figured out they can go around the traditional press. And I'm reading right here, as of 2023, 83% of U.S. adults use YouTube, 68% use Facebook, 47% Instagram, 33% TikTok, all those influencers in the room. And people gravitate to those personalities, someone they can identify with, and then it's just one little more step to believe most everything they say. And so what we're getting is less and less of a real journalism of verification coverage of what is an important news event, what is a civic responsibility, I think, of all Americans, which is to pay attention to their political system. And I would like them to watch it, whether it goes to midnight or not.
There you go. You know, conventions have not been substantive in terms of their impact since probably 1952. And so they are always shows. One of the interesting things, having been one of those journalists who went to cover conventions.
And you loved it.
It was fun, but yet I was always struck by how much less impressive they are on the ground than they are actually in television.
Yeah.
The sound that is amplified, the way that the cameras can move from what's impactful on stage to something more interesting if what's going on stage isn't very interesting. So you're getting a distorted vision of what's going on, but I think, David, your point is well taken that it's a show in any case. It's just that it's very hard for television to do anything other than show.
But the difference back in 1952, Rex, was that there were free channels.
Ah.
There weren't any social media influencers.
Yeah.
There wasn't that huge other distraction that Americans can find themselves tuning out as individuals anytime they want. Back then, you either watched it or you turned off the TV.
Yeah.
And it's true that this convention, the Democratic convention, has been very enthusiastic and joyful. But sometimes I wonder whether or not the media, the mainstream media, is buying into it too much. They're not being critical enough about what's happening. If this is a movement, that's one of the strains you hear in coverage. You know, she's developing a movement. Are we not doing what we should do in terms of asking the right questions and covering the protests? Are we just overlooking that?
Well, the protest was tiny. To cover the protests would be to amplify it beyond its actual reach. There were far more cops than there were protesters in Chicago. So the expectation of protests being newsworthy was actually the media creation.
Yeah, we created that.
Remembering 1968.
You ask that question, you're going to have people go, now what happened with the protests?
Mm-hmm.
Right? But the media brought that up.
The media made a big deal out of it because we thought it would be big because in 1968, the protests in Chicago, listen to the echo there, were big. And the protests have been good sized on college campuses. Still, even last spring, nowhere near what 1968 was in terms of the impact and so on. But I think that it would have been a mistake for the media to make too much of that. What we have not done, we in the collective media, is really held politicians to account for anything beyond the sloganeering. So maybe you can't get around it, given that the public wants a good show and the convention is created to give people a show. In fact, they hired a former president of ABC News to create some of the video for the Democratic National Convention, knowing that this could be created to shape the message. So that's just the way politics is these days. It is made to be good for showbiz, and the presentation of news has to reflect to some extent showbiz values because that's how people take in information these days.
And how much of the joy is valid? I mean, I agree with you, Judy, but is the joy part of this partly created by the media? In other words, the down part of this was President Biden wasn't going to leave. And there was day after day, when's he going to step down? Is he going to step down? The Democrats are going to lose. They've lost this thing. It's over. And then so, whew, a change. And then there's joy.
Well, you could call it joy, or you could also call it relief.
Yeah, right. Which is it? Exactly. Yeah.
When the live stream TVs were streaming over the crowds, there were many times, and I've stayed up through the whole thing, people weren't always paying attention. People were walking out during keynote speakers.
Clinton bored people again, as he did in 1988. I was there when when they had to yank him off yank him off the stage.
They should have tried harder. He spoke way too long this time. But yeah, so I think we in the media, sucked into that spirit,
mm-hmm.
which is clear. But there's some people there that just want the Democratic candidate to win.
And the part of broadcast journalism is to find the most interesting cut and use that.
Yeah.
So we're always reducing stuff and taking it out of context just by picking the best 35 seconds.
So as Barbara says, the rubber's about to hit the road. There's going to be coverage now going on and people trying to establish what is really valuable, what is useful for citizens to know about these campaigns. And we will pretty soon be getting to the point of critique where we will be grappling with the issue of how much of the Trump campaign we will focus on when we know that so much of it is not factually based. And this is a very difficult situation, as we talk about often in this program, when you have one candidate who has a very questionable relationship with the truth, to put it mildly. And it is so hard to cover fairly a campaign when there is such a different standard for what is said, frankly, on one side versus the other. That's going to be the challenge for reporters in this campaign.
I think we're failing already. I think we're doing what we did in 2016. We're giving validation to the other side, which is a complete lie or a falsehood. But because he's the front runner and because he said it, we feel we have to give that as a response.
You know, it's interesting. Ken Tingley, the retired editor of the Post Star, a guy that I really appreciate, Ken writes a Substack column regularly, and he has made a big point lately of how much the fundamental of the Republican platform is based upon a lie. Just the introduction about the threat at the border, the crime that is running rampant in the streets, the decay in our cities. And actually, he's pointed out how this is not true and that the platform itself is fundamentally untrue. Therefore, the journalists who cover the campaign need to be making a point of that, which is a very hard thing to do if you're trying to have coverage that reaches everybody, that reaches people who have a bias for Republicans as well as a bias for Democrats.
It's being able to discern between fairness and truth.
Hmm.
And our job is to report the truth, and we want to be fair in doing it, but being fair should not mean giving credence to lies.
Yeah, and I hear NPR, I hear others do that. They'll say falsely, or this is not the truth when they're quoting Trump, but they're still saying the lie again.
Yeah, there's a difference between distortion and untruth. Now, when I listen, for example, to John Faso, our former Republican congressman from this district on the roundtable in WAMC, I'm sometimes yelling at the radio saying, John, that's not true. Actually, he's not lying. he's distorting.
And he's not being held to account by his fellow
but
panelists.
But his distortion is a valid political tool, isn't it?
And politicians have done it for
a Yeah, sure. And both sides do it.
And I think the public is aware of that, and they know it. We don't give them enough credit for that. And I think they recognize this is a show.
I think the New York Times, correct me if it was a different outlet, the Times assessed the comments that were made during those big speeches of this Democratic convention and which things were kind of lies or which things were distortions or which were mistruths. And there weren't really, I think, any out-and-out lies, but there were the things you're talking about, Rex, where things might have been taken somewhat out of context or wasn't the complete story or was maybe an exaggeration. Or
Bernie Sanders got caught up in an
mostly false. Yeah, Bernie Sanders, when he says that unemployment was soaring when the Biden-Harris administration took office. Well, not really. And now there are these fact-checking efforts on a lot of the media.
But do they matter? And I think studies show they don't.
Well, how are we in the media going to accurately report things like new job numbers, which are difficult to understand and difficult to report, and the latest ones that are coming out would be unfavorable to the message that the Democrats are trying to get across? And some of the numbers are old. They're old numbers. They could be outdated.
Yeah, and they're just now getting updated so that instead of 225,000 jobs a month on average, 174,000 jobs, still the economy was growing. And this is not a distortion. This is nothing unusual.
But the distortion will be the Republicans will use that and say, see, it's going down. They thought it was going up, but it's not. It's going down.
You know, anybody who's had one of these conversations, these difficult conversations with the crazy old uncle who believes Trump, everything he says, you will say, well, he's lied 40,000 times. They don't care. Or they will justify it in their heads somehow that it's not really a lie. They're believing what they want to believe, and telling them that these are lies is not working. But it still needs to be done.
It's cognitive dissonance. Mm-hmm. It comes into your head. You don't like it. You believe in something else. You find the reasons to push it aside. Even if those reasons have no justification, are completely fabricated, and make you look foolish.
So what's a reporter to do?
Oh, there you go.
Thanks, Judy. Thanks a lot, Judy.
I don't know. It all comes down to that great philosopher, Paul Simon. Man hears what he wants to hear and disregards the rest. Lie, lie, lie. Okay. Speaking of people who had an impact in the media, Phil Donahue has died. And he did actually start as a local reporter in Ohio. But he became a figure who had such an impact in the way we all did our jobs, I think, any of us in the media, because of his interactivity with his audience. I think that was the fundamental thing, right? He was a guy who brought his audience into a talk show, and it kind of changed the way we deal with news consumers at a moment when the internet was making people into news creators as well.
I thought he was really good, and when he interviewed, he listened. He did less talking and more listening than traditional interviewers, and that's how he elicited such wonderful answers or wonderful amounts of information out of people from the audience and his guests. The other thing, he tackled topics that in that day were not being discussed and brought to light issues that middle America was trying to keep in the closet.
The most frequent guests were Ralph Nader, Gloria Steinem, and the Reverend Jesse Jackson.
Now think about the issues that come out of that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I heard an interview that Joe Donahue had done with him where he talked about how he realized very quickly that his audience members often asked better questions than he could come up with. So he wanted that interaction. He wanted to give them an opportunity to ask a question because it always ended up being a better question than even he had thought of. The other part, though, was that he was a realist. And he said, if I don't get up in a dress and talk about cross-dressing, and if I don't have these wacky topics, if nobody's watching, then what's the point? In other words, he understood that he had a show and he had to get ratings.
But he had a short-lived show, and he got knocked off, if
when
you might have to correct me on the facts.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, because he was too liberal and too liberal for the liberal stations. I give Phil Donahue a ton of credit for what he tried to bring, what he successfully brought to the public on women's rights, gay rights, pharmaceutical issues, corporate greed. And he was really great at what he did.
We need to get to one more topic since three of us in this room came out of the print background. That is,
unless you count my college paper, the tangerine.
Oh, okay. The tangerine.
Four for four. The banana, the orange, the pineapple, and
the tangerine. I won't tell you what we called it on April Fool's Day.
Oh, right. Anyway, the Strib, as it's known, the Minneapolis Star Tribune is now called the Minnesota Star Tribune. And defying the trend of local news cutting back, they are now hiring hiring correspondents, putting offices all around the state of Minnesota. Now, the good news is this paper's owned by a billionaire, so he's making an investment.
A kindly billionaire. Yeah. So you want a billionaire who's going to really want real news. I thought it was exciting and different and encouraging.
Content is king, and content is what's going to save us. We need more content. We need great content, and that's what will bring the readers, the listeners to us, and will make us profitable in the future.
So we'll be following this, right? We will come back to this, folks, and let you know how things go at the Strib. This is a word that we've taught our listeners today. All right, that's all we have time for here.
Thank goodness.
How about that? That's our producer, Dave Gustina, saying that. Barbara Lombardo is here, Judy Patrick, and I'm Rex Smith. We are grateful to you folks for joining us this week and hope you'll come back again next week for The Media Project.
She employed skullduggery. She up and cut her husband's only throat. She chopped him into fragments. She stuffed him in a trunk. She shipped it all back yonder to her uncle in Podunk. Now newspaper men meet such interesting people. It must have startled poor old Sadie's unk. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, city desk. Hold the press, extra, extra, read all about it. It's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspaper men meet such interesting people.
The Media Project is a national production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio. This week's projectors include former Times Union editor and current Upstate American Substack columnist Rex Smith, Judy Patrick, Vice President for Editorial Development for the New York Press Association and former editor of the Daily Gazette, and Barbara Lombardo, adjunct professor at the University at Albany and former editor of the Saratogian. You can listen to The Media Project anytime at WAMCpodcast.org or anywhere you get your podcasts. I'm your producer, David Gustina. Thanks for listening.
When they know they've got a people's fight to wage. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, newspaper guild. Got a free new world to build. Meet the people, that's a thrill. All together fits the bill. Oh, newspapermen are such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the guild. Now, publishers are such interesting people. Their policy is an acrobatic thing. They claim to represent the common people. It's funny, Wall Street never has complained. Ah, but publishers have worries, for publishers must go to working folks for readers and to big shots for their dough. Now publishers are such interesting people. It could be prostitution, I don't know. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, circulation, ting-a-ling-a-ling, advertising, get those readers, get that payoff. What a headache, what a mess. Oh, publishers are such interesting people. Let's give 3 cheers for freedom of the press.